Today, we are really eager to unpack the myths in education. I'm sure you've seen our recent advocacy campaign to demonstrate impact of evidence of professional learning, and that's a really important myth that we are trying to debunk, that there is no evidence of effectiveness of professional learning. So all of this is part of the same initiative. And I'll say we do this in our magazine, in our social media, and in other types of outreach, in webinars like this, and in our conference. And as you know, this webinar today is a preview of a full-day session at the upcoming Learning Forward conference in St. Louis in a couple of weeks. I can't believe it's just in a couple of weeks, but it actually really is. So if you haven't yet registered for the webinar, I mean for the conference, we'll make sure to put a link into the chat box so you can register there. And as I mentioned briefly, this webinar is what we are calling a Think Fast webinar. It's only 30 minutes as opposed to the more traditional hour-long webinar. And this is really to encourage conversation among participants. This is really a great opportunity to engage in a discussion with these two experts today. It's a way to wake you up on a Monday morning, hopefully. But it also means that we encourage you to think of your questions and post your questions in the chat box all throughout the conversation. And we'll definitely make sure we leave plenty of time at the end for conversations and questions. Okay, so I am pleased now to introduce Dr. Doug Reeves and Dr. Thomas Guskey, who I believe is joining us on the phone now. Dr. Reeves is the founder of Creative Leadership Solutions, a global research and consulting firm focused on professional learning. He is the author of more than 30 books and more than 100 articles on leadership and organizational effectiveness. Dr. Reeves has received numerous honors, including twice being named to the Harvard University Distinguished Authors Series. I almost feel like these two individuals today need no introduction, but I'll do it anyway and just say that we are really pleased to have you join us today. Dr. Thomas Guskey is a professor of educational psychology in the College of Education at the University of Kentucky, and is known for his work in professional development and educational change. He served on the policy team of the National Commission on Teaching and America's Future, and on the task force to develop the standards for professional learning. He is the author or editor of more than 20 books, and we, as I said, are really pleased to have him here with us today. So with that, and a reminder to post your questions, I will turn it over to Dr. Reeves.
Well, thanks, everybody, and thanks, Elizabeth. Tom, are you on us with video?
Not with video, Doug. I'm speaking
with video. Yeah, when this happens to me, what I do is I have put a picture of George Clooney up there and just go by all this. That'd be my recommendation. Welcome, everybody, and we are really excited to be seeing you in just a few weeks at Learning Forward. What we wanted to do in the next few minutes is talk about some common misunderstandings about research. Tom has certainly been a mentor and a leader in this field. I've learned so much from his writing and his research because he kind of represents the gold standard of what the rest of us ought to be aspiring to do. So, Tom, I'm really grateful that you're willing to join us on this.
Well, thanks, Doug. It's an honor to be here with you today. I don't know that I can count myself as a mentor, but I've always sort of had a passion for research and like being involved in those activities and trying to do it well. Those are the kind of classes I get to teach at the university in research design and what we call quantitative inquiry, which is our sort of fancy name for statistics. It's always been wonderful to work with students in that area and trying to help them understand what we do with research and how to do it well.
Well, one of the questions that I wanted to ask you to kind of get us started here are, you know, you and I are both perhaps recovering statisticians, and One of the things I worry about is the illusion of precision that sometimes quantitative inquiry gives us. And so if we were advising people who were listening to test out claims and evidence in educational research, maybe you could give me some advice on how can we best test those claims, even when they sound very authoritative?
Yes, well, one of the topics that we'll explore in some depth in our session at Learning Forward is exactly that, the idea that in research we always generate numbers, but those numbers always have some error in it. The idea is that when research studies are conducted, we do them with samples, and then we try to sort of infer properties from the sample to the general population. But whenever you draw a sample from any population, there's always some what's called sampling error. You hope it's representative, but and you do certain procedures to ensure that it is, but in many cases we know that those samples can be different from the population or they can be extraneous in some way. So whenever you look at a statistic, and one of the things we'll focus on particularly is effect sizes, you know that there's some sort of error associated with that, that even when you combine results from multiple studies, that they don't give you exactly the same effect size every time. So that if we assume in doing a meta-analysis that the treatment is always the same, that the treatment is going to have a constant effect, and there's flexibility or variation in the effect sizes, then something other than that particular innovation has to be causing those that variation. And it's sort of incumbent upon researchers to explore what might cause that variation. I looked recently and I've written about some of the things that are calculated with regard to the effects of feedback on student learning. We know that's a really good thing, and we know that generally that is a very positive effect. But if you look at people that have studied this and looked at combining studies, we find that the effect sizes for feedback on student learning can range from as small as -1 to +1.5. That's a huge range. And so what researchers are starting to do now is turn to those differences and say, what might explain that difference if the innovation is consistent throughout? And so one of the things we'll be taking on as part of our session is how to look at those, how to explore that kind of variation. Think about how those numbers, even if they're calculated to the 100th decimal place, have a lot of error associated with it. And we need to think about sort of bands and areas where we think effect size might fall rather than a specific number calculated to 100th decimal place.
You've made two really important observations that I think our listeners should really think about. And one is just the definitional precision. A word like feedback can mean a lot of different things to different people. And I think if it's going to have practical application in a professional learning context, we have to have a lot more precision in our language. The other thing that you said that really made me think was the context of one observation versus the context of the classroom. Too often, I think what happens, particularly in the sales and marketing realm of educational programs, is that somebody will assert that something has a big impact on student achievement, but the context of that implementation is not at all the varied and complex context that every school I've ever worked in is dealing with.
That's exactly true, Doug, and that's a great observation. I think that as we look at studies and try to understand the nuances of that particular investigation, we find that there are often effects that matter, but they matter depending upon the context. And so to understand the context in which those studies were conducted and how that impacts the results and what we can take from those results given that context is really important. That not that we take the results from a single study and think it's applicable to all conditions or all situations.
Yeah, one of the things, Tom, I always admire about your work, and I had a professor tell me once that she would read things backwards, starting with the reference list to see who they're really paying attention to. And you have always been so generous in your credit to other researchers and other writers to kind of build not just an observation, but rather a mountain of evidence before you come to a conclusion. By the way, if you know, I everywhere I go, I talk about the article that you and Susan and several colleagues wrote about a century of research on grading. I know that's not our topic today, but it is illustrative of the mountain versus the pebble idea of a lot of people have pebbles of research, but it's the mountains that we need to pay attention to that really find different scholars from different backgrounds and different times all coming together to create what I would call the preponderance of evidence.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Doug. And I would add too for our listeners that it's a trait that I think we both share. You're very careful about making sure when statements are made that you cite relevant research to support those. We don't want people making major policy changes based on opinions or conjecture. And so to provide that evidence and then allow people to be able to look at it and figure out whether it is applicable to their context is a very important part of what I think we can do is try to be innovators and people who are recommending changes in educational policies and practices and lead to better things for students.
I want to make sure that I invite our audience to, there's a hand raising function that you can use at any time, and our colleagues at Learning Forward will recognize you. So if we've got people who want to make a contribution, including a challenge, this is a safe and appropriate place to push back if you think that we're getting some things wrong. But we'd appreciate your questions as well as your challenges. Tom, one of the things I want to make sure that I introduce when we're together in December is kind of a typology of research, because there is so much that I would call personal journey stories, a sample size of one, that are masquerading as research. And I want to, but at the same time, one really important thing that I wanted to ask you to help us better understand is even acknowledging things like margins of error in sample sizes and margins of error in effect sizes and so on. What we don't want people to do is throw up their hands and say, well, heck, it's all just guesswork. You can find an expert to say anything. We want people as a result of this conference to be critical consumers, but not so exasperated they're non-consumers. Is this a aspiration?
No, I agree with you completely. In fact, I become so frustrated with people who say these things like, well, researchers never agree, and they're always talking about the nuances of studies and complexities and the influence of context, and all that's true. But that doesn't mean you throw up your hands and say we should operate without considering the research. We have a very well-established professional knowledge base in our field. And unfortunately, and this is something we discovered over and over again as we have explored the area of grading, that knowledge base is not finding its way into practice. What we do, especially in the area of grading, is not based on a knowledge base that's been accumulated over the 100 years. We do what has always been done. We base things on tradition, or we base things on the opinion of people who have strong and passionately held perspectives on this, but those perspectives may not be well informed. So I think that the idea of being almost negative or have some animosity toward the research field is detriment to our progress. That we really need to think about looking at their research carefully, understanding that it does have nuances and it needs to be considered carefully before we make grand overall generalizations from it. But to ignore it is to ignore it to our detriment.
Which we would never do in the other fields. There's margins of errors in engineering and in medicine and in all manner of other fields as well, but that doesn't mean that we ignore the knowledge base.
Right.
So one of the things I wanted to ask you is, you know, you're quite right that there is a divergence between research and practice, and sometimes that happens in education, but you might have seen the Elizabeth Hardy note in the Times that 40% of the syllabi for literacy instruction at the university level is not consistent with research. And I don't know if you agree with her or not, but I think part of what sometimes we have to own also is that we're not pointing the finger just at K-12. I think we need to own this at the university level as well.
You're absolutely right, Doug. In fact, let me take it one step further. With two colleagues, we've recently conducted a study where we looked at rating policies and practices among university faculty. We randomly selected a very large sample of universities and four-year colleges. We chose four academic departments within those, and then were able to look at the grading syllabi of the grading policies that are described in syllabi of professors and of instructors of courses there. We chose introductory courses because those were the most common. And if you think 40% is a good match or a poor match to the current practice, we found among university syllabi, where grading policy happens to be spelled out in syllabi because it's a contractual thing between a faculty member and the students in the class, that about 80% of those were not aligned with current practice or with current knowledge base about effective practice. So it depends on the area. Not only are we remiss in terms of what we're doing aligning with the current knowledge base in the subject areas, but we're completely remiss with regard to grading practices we use at the college university level.
So this is so interesting because I want to make sure that there's two dramatically different inferences that one might draw from what you just said. And one is, hey, we need to do a better job of aligning policy and practice. And the other inference is, well, since university grading policies are so toxic, I guess that's what we've got to do in K-12 to toughen them up for bad policy at the university.
Yes, I hear that all the time. And to me, it's kind of like saying, knowing that our students are going to see poor teaching when they go on to the college university, then the best preparation we can offer is to teach them poorly today. That just doesn't solve the problem. I think another way of looking at it would be to say maybe the very best preparation we can offer students, no matter what they see, as they leave our classrooms, is to have them learn excellently what we set out to teach them today. And if we do that, they will be better prepared when they enter classroom environments where the instruction and grading policies are less than optimal or more poorly aligned with what we know to be better practice.
Yeah.
Could I interrupt for just one moment? Yeah. I'm sorry, this is Elizabeth. We have a couple of questions that in the chat box that I think are relevant to this point. Veronica Smith has put several questions in the chat box about research focusing on professional learning for higher education educators. And I'm wondering if you would like to address her question specifically.
Would you mind reading this, please?
Yes, I'm wondering actually if we can unmute her.
Yeah, let's unmute her because she has her hand raised.
Right. Excellent.
Veronica, you are unmuted.
Oh, great. Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
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 Oh, great. This is very timely. I'm presenting at the University of Arizona a keynote on to a pan-university group of faculty and graduate students and industry professionals about building diverse interdisciplinary research community focused on built environment. And so one of the things I've been asked to talk about is what are the keys to really being able to build a learning community that is going to be able to conduct convergence research? And so I've been asked to cite research on, you know, what are the benefits of, you know, learning cultural responsiveness and being able to communicate and facilitate team science and those types of things. So I was wondering if you could, you know, direct me to, you know, the best mountains of research that are kind of supporting that.
Maybe Tom and I could divide labor on that one, because I want to suggest a resource that we sometimes underuse at the university level, and that is professional journals. You know, you have academic journals that are like Journal of Ed Psych and so on that are peer-reviewed and you know, very important contributors, but I think some of the professional journals, and Learning Forward is a good example of that, that even though it's very high quality, it's a different sort of journal from some of the academic statistical journals. And so to finally come to the point, a great resource that you might want to look at is the Marshall Memo. I don't know if you're subscribing to it or not, but they just completed 16 years of, you know, thousands of articles that you can search by subject, and it gives you a thoughtful diversity of opinion, so it's not all going to be the same thing. It's marshallmemo.com, and I strongly recommend it as a great resource. But Tom probably has a better insight on other research support.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you on that, Doug. I think the Marshall Memos, Kim has always done such a great job of every month looking at popular journals, both academic journals and practitioner journals, pulling from those the articles that are particularly relevant to current issues in education, offers a quick summary of those. Having had the honor of having Kim review some of my pieces, he's terrific at being able to capture the essence of it. He always checks with folks to make sure that what he's saying aligns well with what they intended to communicate, word of law. So I think that's a tremendous resource. The Learning Forward Journal 2, the Professional Learner, is fantastic. I think that it does a really good job of capturing certain issues. The other two that I recommend would be the ASCD Journal Educational Leadership and the Phi Delta Kappa Journal Kappa. They are both designed to provide a sort of conversational approach to some of these really pressing issues. And if you both are sort of thematically oriented so that you won't always get the same perspective on these different issues. In fact, I'm always delighted to see in some of the issues counterpoints, but there's another aspect of it, particularly the Educational Leadership Journal. At the end, they always have a sort of compilation of research in the area. And so they ask a member of their staff, there are sometimes an invited scholar to review the research in this area, do a quick summary of it all. And those are always really thoughtful, and they bring sort of a synthesis to the perspectives presented by other authors of other articles in the journal. So I think those resources I return to.
And Veronica, since you have the opportunity to maybe influence the university group, I would just make one final note when you're talking about the context of teams. I think we could do a dramatically better job of doing team dissertations. It's always struck me as deeply ironic that we ask people to write a dissertation about cooperative learning entirely alone. When I think if a better structure would be to have students using different methods, using different backgrounds, different perspectives, but addressing a similar problem, they would make better contributions to the field. I've got a volunteer group here in Boston called finishthedissertation.org, and I'm on a tear to try to make these things somewhat more meaningful. It's free and non-commercial. All we try to do, maybe we have listeners here who are working on their dissertations. If you go to finishthedissertation.org, you find free and non-commercial help. But Veronica, if you're going to have a chance to influence those people, make a pitch for teams instead of individuals.
Yeah, I think that's I'm really glad you mentioned that because so we're an evaluation and research firm, and we've been working with interdisciplinary research efforts over the last 10 years that have been funded by the National Science Foundation. And one of the sources of tension between those traineeships and the PhD students' dissertation is that, you know, they're working on these team projects or something that's interdisciplinary focused, and then their faculty advisor will be telling them that, you know, and they really need to spend more time on their, you know, monodisciplinary focused dissertation. And, you know, this concept of a team dissertation would be one way to relieve that tension.
Thank you so much, Veronica. I'm going to try to get in another question before the top of the hour. We only have a couple minutes left, unbelievably. But Katie Evanson asked for the presenter's thoughts on Hattie's recent meta-analysis. I know that's probably more than a three-minute answer, but if you could take a crack at that, that would be great.
Yeah. Yeah. Tom, go ahead. I know you've looked at that deeply.
Oh, yes. Well, John Hattie is a personal friend, and I like John tremendously. He's done so much for the field in pulling all these things together. And John, I think, is the quality researcher that he is, also recognizes the dilemmas that doing something like this can provide. One of the things that John and I have talked about and something we're you know, I've sort of pressed him to consider is to think about when these effect sizes are generated to provide instead of a single number that is estimated at the 100th decimal place, to provide what we, what statisticians call confidence interval, which says here's the number, and sort of it all sort of boils down to around this. But there's tremendous variation in the studies that have been conducted. And so it may be this, but it may be significantly more, it may be significantly less. And actually then to talk about some of the factors that contribute to those differences. I mean, for example, Kingston and Nash did a synthesis of a meta-analysis of research on feedback, especially from formative assessments. And it is their synthesis that I described, having identified a difference in effect sizes from negative 1 to positive 1.5. They then took the step of trying to understand what could contribute to those differences, and they found that the influence feedback depended somewhat on the subject area, which it was. It was more effective in some subject areas than others. It was somewhat dependent on the kind of the level of the students. That what worked for elementary students was different from what worked for middle school or high school students. The format of the feedback also made a difference. The type of training the teachers were engaged in to provide the feedback made a difference. So all these things that come in to confound that are important. And I think that if we would think of effect sizes not as a single number that's accurate to the 100th decimal place, but instead of a range of possible effect sizes, you'd understand that there's tremendous overlap in these different innovations. And a lot depends on context factors, it depends on implementation factors, and those things need to be taken into consideration before we make major decisions with regard to policy or practice.
I completely support what you just heard, and also appreciate your friendship for John. He has been a friend of mine of long standing as well, and he is, as we say in the biz, a scholar and a gentleman. Two footnotes that I would just add briefly, and that is, number one, John is also one of those scholars who, when there's a mistake, admits it and fixes it, and that to me is a real test. Somebody else on the chat box asked, How are you a good critical researcher or good critical consumer? Look for people who admit their mistakes, and beware the researcher who is always conveniently right, and never found a hypothesis that they couldn't support. So, I think that modesty and acknowledgement of error is what distinguishes researchers. And secondly, distinguish between the researcher and the salespeople, because I think honestly some of the stuff that happens in research is not well served by over-enthusiastic salespeople who let their certainty get ahead of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hate to do this, but we are at the top of the hour. So that went by very quickly, and I hope that this webinar designed to whet your appetite for attending the pre-conference all-day session succeeded, and people can see the link to register and sign up for this wonderful conversation. So thank you very much, Dr. Reeves and Dr. Guskey, for your time today and for starting off our week with such a thoughtful conversation. And thanks to everyone for joining us. We'll send out the slides and the recording in the follow-up email.
Great to be with you.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
Yeah, we really appreciate being a part of it.
Wonderful. Thanks so much. Mm-hmm. Bye.